Talk Line Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.
Good evening, and welcome back to Mask's weekly radio show on family matters. Mask, mothers and fathers aligned, saving kids, kids of all ages and all stages of mental health issues, including in-school issues and addictions. If you know someone that needs a referral for a therapist, an inpatient, outpatient program, or if you want to attend a parent support group, feel free to call our anonymous confidential helpline at 718-758-0400. Again, I'll repeat our number. Maybe you want to jot it down for yourself, a loved one, maybe someone you usually would sit next to in shul. Our number again, 718-758-0400. Tonight, I'm really honored, really, really, really honored to have with us the world-renowned, I mean, I'm talking about somebody that is just an amazing special educator. His name is Dr. Rick Lavoie, who has served as an administrator of residential programs for children with special needs since 1972. And he has been on numerous television appearances, CBS and Good Morning America, ABC on Disney Channel presents him. He is really the best specialist consultant for learning disabilities to many different agencies. And I really, really want to welcome you on tonight. Thank you for making time in your most busy schedule for being on with us. Welcome again on our show tonight, Dr. Rick Lavoie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And thank you for the very, very kind introduction. I should send that off to my kids. Thank you for the nice introduction. You know, I believe so strongly in the work that you folks do for the Brooklyn community. I've kind of fallen in love with the neighborhoods of Brooklyn the last couple of years since our grandkids are being raised there. And the work you do, I wonder if Brooklyn realizes how fortunate they are to have Mask in their community. There, as I travel around the country, or used to travel before everything fell apart, so many communities would just starve for information and referrals. And so it's good work that you do, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you. And I so enjoyed your program that you did for us. It's already 2 years ago, and I hope to have you after the pandemic again to bring you back to Brooklyn, so that we can offer you wonderful workshops for our community. Is it okay if I address you as Rick, my dear please, colleague, friend?
Please do. We're great friends. We go way back. Please
right,
do.
Right. So I would like to bring up the book about that you wrote on helping the child with learning disabilities find social success. Mm-hmm. It's so much work to be your friend. And I know you emphasize that parents remember the basic tenets of child development and urge parents to view a child's behavior and the progress through a developmental lens. Can you share what you mean by that for my listeners, please?
Surely, and this is applicable to all children, not just children with special needs, which is kind of my specialty. But if I were king, I would pass a law that every parent and every teacher had to take a basic course in human development. Because if we really understood the way kids develop, I think we would greatly decrease the amount of conflict we have with them. I'll tell you what I mean. I tell the story of going to the beach one day with my wife. We live here on Cape Cod, and I love watching kids. I mean, you just learn so much by just observing kids interacting with each other. And we were sitting on the beach, and this mom showed up with 7 or 8 little kids, probably between the ages of 4 and 12. Some were hers, and some were neighborhood kids. And And they all started running around and playing, and she was trying to herd them like kittens. And I've got pretty good radar, and I picked out one kid who I knew was going to be the one I wanted to watch. And it was a little kid, about 5 years old. And he went up to his mother, and he said, "Mom, my towel's wet. I got my towel wet. Can I get a dry towel?" And she said, "I told you to keep the towels dry. How did it get wet?" "Well, I used it to carry the mud to make a sandcastle, and it got wet." She said, "Okay, let me tell you, I'm going to give you this towel. It's the last dry towel we have. It's your sister's towel. Do not get it wet. Do you understand? Don't get it wet." He says, "Fine." I watch him. He wraps himself in the towel, sitting on the blanket. Then he gets up and starts walking around. Then he starts walking closer to the water. And I thought, this cannot end well. He walks into the water. He's got the dry towel around his shoulders. He goes into the water up to his ankles and up to his knees and a little almost up to his waist. And the whole time he's holding his arms up to keep the towel dry, doing what Mom told him to do. Suddenly somebody throws him a Frisbee. He reached for the Frisbee, let go of the towel. The towel falls in the water. Now the towel is wet. He wrings it out and he brings it up to her and very sheepishly shows her the towel, and she just starts. "Why did you leave the towel? Why did you go near the water? Why did you get the towel wet? Why didn't you do what you were told?" Asking him all these questions. And I'm sitting there thinking, I could solve this mystery in three words. Why did he leave the towel? Why did he walk in the water? Why did he get the towel wet? Three words, Mom. Because he's five. Because he's five. Five-year-olds don't have what's called consequential thought. We have consequential thought. If you wanted to keep something dry, you know well that the closer you get to water, the better chance it's going to get wet. That's what consequential thought is. Five-year-olds don't have consequential thought. Why did he drop the towel in the water and get the towel wet? Simply because he's five. And the example I use is adolescents. We all get so upset with our adolescents. All they want to do is eat and sleep. All they want to do is eat and sleep. Well, let's take a look from a developmental point of view. Adolescence is the second biggest growth spurt that a human being has. You know, you can gain 30 pounds and grow 8 inches in a period of a couple of years. It's the second biggest growth spurt you have. The biggest growth spurt we have is infancy. You can double your weight and double your length in a period of 16 months. What do infants do to fuel that incredible growth? What do the doctors say this kid needs a lot of in order to fuel his growth? He needs a lot of food and a lot of sleep. And nobody gets mad at their infant for wanting to eat and sleep all the time, but we get mad at our adolescents for wanting to eat and sleep all the time, and they're doing it for the same reason. You know, my child used to be fun to play games with. Now he gets mad if he loses. Why is he doing that? Because he's 11. That's what happens when you're 11. You know, my son used to want to be with me all the time. Now he won't walk down the street in Brooklyn with me by his side. Why is he doing that? Because he's 15. What I'm saying is so many of the problems kids give us are very predictable if you understand development. And I think it's been critically important in this crisis that we've been facing together for the last year for parents to take a real good look at what is the child doing simply because he's on schedule in terms of a developmental point of view.
Wow. So yes, parents and teachers, Rick, talk about children, learning disabilities. They generally focus on the child's academic struggles. But I know that you feel we need to increase our focus on social skills. Can you tell us what you mean by social skills, and why do you feel that's so important or more important?
Well, you know, social skills, when you say social skills, unfortunately, people think of manners and, you know, which fork to use in a meal. And that's really what social skills are. In fact, we're trying to, and I keep forgetting to do this myself, but we try to use the term social competence more often. It's the ability to interact with others. And the reason I feel so strongly about this and have been beating this drum now for about 40 years is I had the great blessing for 20 years of my career to work in residential schools, literally getting the kids up in the morning, putting them to bed at night, seeing a kid 24 hours a day, you know, 365. And I gained a very great appreciation for the fact that for kids with learning disabilities, certainly they struggle in school. But the reality is the typical kid in the state of New York spends about 1,080 hours a year in the classroom. That's only about 5% of his waking time. 95% of a kid's time is spent in social environments, on the playground, on the school bus, at grandma's, on weekends, at birthday parties and bar mitzvahs, that 95% of a kid's time is spent in social environments. And what we're finding is kids who have difficulty academically also have difficulty socially. I think that what we've been talking about for a long time is we used to think the kid failed in school, therefore he didn't have any friends. What we realize now is even if he was doing well in school, he'd have difficulty making friends because some of the difficulties a kid has in school bleed over into the social world. It's, and if there's any professionals listening, I get so tired, frankly, of hearing my colleagues say, we've got enough to do in terms of teaching kids how to read, write, and spell. We can't be spending time on social skills. The parents don't want us to do that. I've spent my entire career talking to special needs parents, and I'll tell you this, my friend, probably 100 times in my career, I've had a parent sit across from my desk and put her or his head on my desk and sob about that kid. And not once would that parent crying because the kid couldn't read it, the kid couldn't write it, the kid couldn't spell. When a parent's reduced to that kind of pain, it's about their kids being socially isolated and rejected from other kids.
Absolutely. And that's the primary reason that you encourage that parents should work directly on the social skills, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Can academic struggles impact upon the social interactions?
Yeah, they can. And let me tell you the example I use. If you talk to a language therapist, they say there's about 400 language skills people need to develop in order to be fluent in language. One of them is a skill that you use every day, I use every day, but we never think about it. It's called interrogation. And I'll tell you what it means. If I were to ask you to ask your daughter what we're having for dinner, if I were to say to you, please ask her what we're having for dinner, you would go to her and say, what are we having for dinner? You take my declarative sentence, ask what we're having for dinner, and turn it into a question. What are we having for dinner? You do it hundreds of times a day. It's very natural. Many of our kids can't do that. But look at the impact that has on the kid. Because so much social interaction involves asking questions and answering questions. Social interaction and conversations like a volleyball game. I serve to you, you hit it back to me, I hit it back to you. That's the way a conversation is supposed to go. But if you can't ask questions, you can't get involved. And so even that one little tiny language problem can cause social skill problems. You and I haven't been together in a couple of years. If I were to go visit you in Brooklyn and we were to meet at an auditorium, we would probably spend our first 5 minutes asking each other questions in order to get the conversation going. How was your trip? How are you feeling? How are your kids? That's how you get conversations going. So that's just an example of one little tiny language problem that can cause huge social skills problems for kids.
So what are the sub-skills that make it so difficult for a child to be accepted by their peers, their friends?
Well, you were very kind to mention my book. And I think the reason that my book, So Much Work to Be a Friend, got the attention it did is we did something that had never really been done before. We broke social skills into individual skills, into individual sub-skills. It used to be back in the day, I'd say to a teacher, I'm sending you a child and he has poor social skills. Well, that doesn't tell the teacher anything. The teacher doesn't know where to begin. So we've broken it into sub-skills. And a lot of this is on my website too, into sub-skills that we've recognized. So instead of saying this kid has poor social skills, I can say he has trouble with timing and staging, has trouble with social prediction, social memory. I can give specific things. And let me just run a couple of them by you. Social prediction. Until we had our pandemic, I, spent 40 years on the road. We are a very divided country politically. I have very, very strong political views, but I never voice them when I speak to an audience. Why? Because I have social prediction. I can predict how they would react. I would predict how an audience of 500 people would react if I took a very strong political stand one way or the other. That's what social prediction is. Our kids, many of them don't have that. So many times you find yourself saying to your child, what did you think would happen when you said that? Well, they didn't think what would happen when they said that. Social memory. We know the kids have our kids have difficulty memorizing the times tables and the alphabet. Well, they also have social memory problems. So they forget when they go to grandma's house, they forget you're not supposed to let the cat out of the house. They forget those things. Because they have a memory problem. So there's all kinds of sub skills. One quick one is what's called timing and staging. Timing and staging basically says that the kids don't understand that a relationship is a process that you go through. So here's what happens. The new kid moves into the neighborhood. The kid with good social skills waits till he sees the little boy outside his house, and he pulls up and he says, "Hi, my name's Mike. What's your name?" "My name's Andrew." "Hi, nice to meet you, Andrew. Welcome to the neighborhood. Where are you going to go to school?" "Oh, yeah, that's where I go to school. Maybe we'll see each other in the school bus. You know, sometimes my brothers and I go shopping at the mall. Maybe you can come with us on your bike." "Okay, nice meeting you," and drives away. Perfect. That's a great gambit. That's a great way to enter a social situation. They may or may not be friends, but that was a great first start. Now, the kid in the neighborhood with poor social skills goes running up to the door of the new kid, bangs in the door. "Hi, my name's Michael. You have to let's sleep over. You can sleep over at my house tonight. You've got to sit next to me in the bus, but you can't talk to Michael, to Billy, because he makes fun of me. And my parents go to Disney World every year. You can come with us." And the new kid says, "Whoa, much too fast." The second kid doesn't understand that it's a process. Your kid's not going to be your best friend just because he moved next door. And so what we've done is broken the idea of poor social skills into these sub skills that can actually be taught.
And the book really does a great job in explaining that.
Thank you.
And it's a very good read for parents because, I mean, it is a big book, but it's an amazing, full of information. But I do want you to please explain some of the common mistakes that parents may make when a child struggles socially.
Yeah, okay, and there were a few of them. One is what I call deep end of the pool, and that is a very well-intentioned mom saying to Andrew, "Andrew, go outside and make a friend. Go outside and don't come back until you've got a friend." That would be much like saying to a kid with dyslexia to, "Here, take this book, go in the corner, and don't come up till you know how to read." Making friends and breaking into friends into groups of kids is a very difficult thing to do, and the book tells you how to do that. But the first mistake is deep end of the pool. Go outside. All the kids are outside. Go outside and make a friend. It's just not that simple for our kids. The second is an over-reliance on medication. I happen to believe that medication is the treatment of choice for many of our kids. I've seen it save the lives of kids. I've seen it change the lives of kids. But it will not improve your kids' social skills. Just giving a kid medication is not going to make this kid a better social skill person. It really takes training. The third thing I think mistakes make is the idea of mainstreaming, that many parents think, if the kid has poor social skills, I'm going to put him in classes with kids with good social skills, and he'll catch it like you catch the flu. And it's just not that simple. My argument to that is, most parents that I know of kids who struggle socially are very good social skills people themselves. The parents are very good at it. The kids aren't. Well, that's enough evidence for me to say that our kids don't learn good social skills just by watching other people's good social skills. And the last thing I think is, a very well-intentioned mistake, is there's a whole cottage industry out there of social skills training programs. You can sign up and go to, and I believe in them. To this point, if your son wants to be a concert violinist, you might go into the city and you might get the best violin teacher you can find in Manhattan and give this kid 3 hours of violin lessons every Saturday. But that's not going to make him a good violinist. What's going to make him a good violinist is practice and recitals and studying the history of the violin and the history of music. That's what's going to make him a world-class violinist. It's the same with social skills. Just sitting down a few hours a week with somebody who's trained to teach social skills is not going to give the kid good social skills unless he does the practice and that kind of stuff during the week. And parents can be very helpful in doing that.
So you gave 3 examples. I'm wondering if I could ask you to give 3 specific strategies maybe that teachers could use to help that, you know, isolated, rejected child in the class.
Well, I think the key to the whole thing is quite simple, and that is, I used to do a workshop called the 4 R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and relationships, that the most important thing if a kid's being bullied, if a kid's being isolated, the most important thing a teacher can do is show that she accepts that kid, that she embraces that kid, she likes that kid, she enjoys that kid's company, she calls on him in class, she greets him at the door, and demonstrate to the other kids, I like him. And if the teacher has a good relationship with the students will begin to say, well, gee, you know, Miss Berkowitz likes him, and we don't, but she's smarter than we are. Maybe we should take another look at him and see why he's so accepted by the teachers. Show acceptance. Find what my colleague and friend Bob Brooks talks about, islands of competence. Find one thing this kid can do well, whether it's an art or music or whatever, and celebrate it. Make a big deal out of it. Thirdly, stay totally away from collective punishments. That's an old trick that teachers use of, Andrew wasn't good when we went to the media center today, so we're not going to go to the media center for a week, punishing the entire class for what the child has done wrong. It's just so unfair. And basically, you're asking the kids to do your job for you and take care of Andrew. Conversely, though, collective rewards, where a teacher stands up and says, we all know that Andrew's had such a difficult time learning his spelling words. He got 90 on his test today. That's great. That's wonderful. We'll have a little extra story today. I'm so happy because Andrew's doing so well. And instead of punishing the kids when Andrew does something wrong, you actually reward the kids when Andrew does something right. Those are some strategies that teachers can use.
Thank you. Rick, we're not going to talk about the pandemic, but I'd like you to explain how anxiety in general plays out in social isolation.
Okay, and that's really one of my favorite topics, something I've done a lot of work on. We worry in our society about kids who are depressed. And of course, I do too. A depressed kid is it's a very challenging clinical thing to deal with. But I worry more about kids who are anxious. I was on the Learning Disability Association advisory board for a couple of years, and my goal in that time was to have the word anxiety actually added to the definition of learning disabilities. Because what I find is actually the majority, and maybe the overwhelming majority, of kids with learning problems also have anxiety problems. And again, people use the terms anxiety and depression interchangeably as if they mean the same thing. It really doesn't. They're totally different. And this is just more than a little cute wordplay. This is really the case. Depressed people worry about the past. Anxious people worry about the future. Yep. If you know a child or a friend who's in a depression, he's mourning a loss that he suffered, a loss of a relative or a loss of something. He's focused on the past. Kids with anxiety and adults with anxiety don't focus on the past, they focus on the future. And it's extraordinarily debilitating. If you're a teacher listening to this, this is what it looks like in the classroom. You get up in front of the class and you say, oh, everybody, by the way, next Tuesday, we're going to take a field trip into Manhattan. All the 90% of the kids are, yeah, okay, that's fine. But the kid with anxiety goes right up here. Can I sit near a window in the bus? What if you're sick? Are we still going to go? Should I bring money? What should I wear? What if it rains? Are we still going to go? And just saying we're going to go on a field trip just unleashes this dam of anxiety on the kid's part. And it's extraordinarily debilitating that they're constantly, constantly worried about the future. As kids are beginning to return to school now, we're seeing a tremendous amount of anxiety from kids who had really never done it before, never expressed the anxiety. The key to dealing with anxiety with kids is it's not simple, but it can be kind of profound. And that is just continue to convince them that you're in charge. You'll take care of it. You know, you don't need to worry about that. I'm going to take care of that. Mommy's here, daddy's here, the teacher's here, the coach's here, the rabbi's here. We're going to take care of it. That's an adult problem, and we're going to take care of it. It can do a great deal to assuage their anxiety. We are living in a different world right now, and there's a lot of anxiety in the part of all of us, but I think particularly for kids.
Absolutely, and the pandemic, really, the isolation on kids has been tremendous. The Mask Helpline has never had so many phone calls about anxiety. Yes. We just started our 24th year, over 111,000 families that attended our programs, reached out to MASC. And I must say, in all my years, we never had so many anxiety, of course, like we do now, which everyone, all the organizations say the same. So my last question, if we can just a minute before we run out of time, if you can just give us a tidbit about Fat City. Can't go without asking you about that.
Fat City is a, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version of it, but it's a workshop I came up with in 1985. And some gentleman was in the audience and saw it, and it really changed the way he viewed his kid. What it does, if you, the audience hasn't seen it, it's a workshop that I do where I bring a group of adults together who don't have learning problems, and I actually give them learning problems through some contrived activities. For instance, I say, I make them tell a story around the room, but they can't use any words that contain the letter N. And if you try that, you can try it after after you listen to this program. Just try to tell someone a story without using letters that contain the letter N. And you have a very difficult time finding words. You get stuck in roadblocks. You can't finish a sentence. Well, that's what kids with learning problems, that's their language every day. That's the way. So it was a blessing in my life. I mean, the video, people are always disappointed when they see me now because the video was done, you know, almost 40 years ago, and I'm a different guy than I was then. But it really has made a difference. And if you're looking, if you wouldn't mind, my friend, let me just close with one quick story about it. Again, what it does is it takes adults and makes them, for the first time, realize what the kids are going through. And I was in St. Louis. I was speaking in St. Louis, and I was sitting at the gate waiting to board my flight. And this was back in the day when you go up and get the ticket at the gate. And I went up to the gate, and they had me on first class. And I don't fly first class. I work for nonprofits. And I sat down, I looked at ticket first class. And I said, geez, you know, what do I do here? Do I do the right thing and tell them I made a mistake, or, you know, they made a mistake or what? So my better angels came, and I went up to them and I said, you know, you made a mistake. I'm not on first class. And the woman said, no, Mr. Duffy put you on first class. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't know Mr. Duffy, but I'm not stupid. I'll take it. So I was sitting there, and a few minutes later, this gentleman came over from the airline with a blazer on, and he had a name tag, Mr. Duffy, and he introduced himself. He said, I saw you sitting there. I recognize you. He said, my son's in the eighth grade, and he's had tremendous difficulty in school, and he and I will go literally weeks at a time without speaking to each other. He said the relationship was totally shot. And I went out to work the other day, and I got in my car, and there was a videotape on my seat with a note from him saying, Dad, please watch this.
Wow.
I said, I watched the video in my office, and I left work and went to a school and took him out of class and hugged him for the first time in 5 years.
Wow. Great story.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
That's a tough one to tell sometimes. It really is. But yep. It's absolutely true. And it does have that impact. We never expected it to go anywhere. It really has been around the world. Back, it's huge in Israel, by the way.
Yep.
I get 3 or 4 emails a week from Israel. Yep. So anyway, that's my
story. Thank you, Rick, Dr. Rick Lavoie. Thank you so much for being on. I always love speaking to you, and I hope that we can do another show soon. Thank you. Anybody that wants to get Dr. Lavoie's books, and go on to Amazon, and there are many books you can buy there. So feel free to get them on Amazon. Thank you, Doctor. Nice speaking with you.
It's always a pleasure. You take care of yourself now.
Thank you. You too. My best to your wife.
I'll pass it on.
I wanted to wish everybody a very good evening, a beautiful Shabbos. And remember, always hang in, hold on, and virtually for now, hug tight. Tonight's show is in memory of Rivka Bas Yisrael. Please go online to massparents.org and donate so that we can continue these wonderful programs. Thank you and have a good night.
Thanks for listening.
Talkline Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.